Thanks to Avery and Yaish for the opportunity. So I plan to describe some attempts to understand accreting supermassive black holes. And so I will start with a little bit of the context and then get down to some specific empirical results. So by supermassive, I mean a black hole which is larger than a million times the mass of our sun. And so then the question is, are accreting supermassive black holes common? Are they special? Do they matter? So the only supermassive black holes that we know reside in the centers of galaxies in the universe. And if matter is channeled close to these massive black holes, they accrete and they become the most efficient sustained powerhouses that we know. These galaxies are then called active galaxies, and nuclei called active galactic nuclei, or AGN. So then, if these black holes accrete, they become very easy to spot, and the accretion produces copious amounts of radiation, right from radio to gamma rays. That is every wavelength that we've possibly looked at. And this curve sort of depicts that. And the vertical variation in the plots or dots or squares that you see is real variability in the radiation output. And here's another example of a similar, what we call spectral energy distribution, which shows that the emission is not just continuum, but also in emission lines, mostly atomic, but also molecular. And the continuum emission comes from a wide variety of emission mechanisms, both thermal and non-thermal. So the effect of an accreting supermassive black hole could be subtle. So this picture just illustrates that. So is there a pointer? Nice. That's the first time I've given a talk for the hockey stick. So this is a galaxy without an accreting supermassive black hole, and this is a galaxy with one. And you can see the difference is very subtle. The only difference is that diffraction spike that you can see in the center, which is due to the very sharp point source due to the accreting supermassive black hole. But when you go further out into the universe, you get more luminous objects. And so, for example, here, the accreting supermassive black hole is all-powerful, and so you can't distinguish it from this thing, which is actually just a regular star. You need spectroscopy to distinguish between the two, and so the star shows the typical absorption spectrum like our sun, whereas the accreting supermassive black hole shows very strong emission lines. And you need the resolution of the Hubble Space Telescope to actually discern the galaxy around that very stellar-looking accreting supermassive black hole. So you still see the diffraction spikes and the host galaxy with the high resolution. Sometimes, of course, the accreting supermassive black holes are not subtle at all, like this image in gamma rays of a very nearby active galaxy called Centaurus A, where the gamma ray emission extends onto scales of several hundreds of kiloparsecs. And the same object here showing radio emission, which is synchrotron emission from the plasma, again extending to hundreds of kiloparsecs. Now, what about supermassive black holes that are not accreting? So they're much harder to spot, but it is possible. So for example, in the center of our Milky Way, with infrared imaging, which have tracked the motions of stars in the very center, people have found that there is a supermassive black hole with mass about 4 million times the mass of the sun. And it turns out that virtually every reasonable galaxy in the universe with what we call the bulge of stars in it has a supermassive black hole.
What do you mean by reasonable galaxy? Like, what is that?
Okay, every galaxy with a bulge. every galaxy with a bulge, bulge being the central structure of the galaxy with the stars sort of thermalized in a sense. So the bulge seems to be a necessary condition to host a supermassive black hole. There is some evidence very recently that it may not be a sufficient, I mean, it's, there are galaxies without bulges necessarily, you know, but that's a very controversial thing. So but when I say reasonable galaxy, I mean a galaxy with a bulge definitely seems to have a supermassive black hole in its center. And what has been most interesting is that the mass of the supermassive black hole is correlated with the gravitational potential of the galaxy. So on the x-axis is the stellar velocity dispersion of the galaxy, which is the determined by the gravitational potential, and on the y-axis is the mass of the supermassive black hole. And there is this very strong and intriguing correlation. So what that means is that the growth of the black hole and the growth of the galaxy, or the bulge, has to go hand in hand. What is also interesting is that accreting supermassive black holes fit into the same correlation. So that seems to imply that the accretion is just a phase in the life of every supermassive black hole, maybe more than one phase in the life of every supermassive black hole in the center of a galaxy. And it is not obviously easy to explain this correlation because the scales are so different. I mean, the mass of the black hole is such a small fraction of the mass of the whole galaxy, which is typically 10 to the 11 or more solar masses. The scales are, of course, hugely different. And so black hole and galaxy must co-evolve. So then how do you explain that? So if you look at the supermassive black hole, it can grow in by two means. One is if you have two galaxies merging, and each of them has a supermassive black hole, and then the two supermassive black holes eventually merge, then of course you would have at the end of it a larger supermassive black hole and of course a larger galaxy. The other way in which a supermassive black hole can grow is by accretion, that is by being an active galactic nucleus. So this is an example of another example of an AGN where that's what the galaxy looks like, all the stellar emission, and this is a radio image of the same thing. I'm sorry, the light is kind of reducing the contrast, but nevertheless, you can see this reddish structure, which is reflecting the stellar structure of the galaxy. But this structure, which is much brighter radio emission, oh, that's great, thank you, is actually synchrotron emission caused by the accreting supermassive black hole. And so when the black hole accretes, it increases in mass. So then if you want a correlation between the mass of the growth of the supermassive black hole mass and the galaxy, these things have to go hand in hand. And so one has to devise complex feedback mechanisms between the accreting supermassive black hole and the star formation in the galaxy. So this is actually a real example of the result of two galaxies merging. So you can see that the stellar emission is all over the place. Stellar orbits are messed up. And this particular galaxy does show evidence for a binary black hole in its center. This is a zoomed out version of that. So there are other examples of this. And in this case, definitely those two central sources are accreting supermassive black holes. And so this is an example of computer simulations which have attempted to explain the feedback between the accretion of the supermassive black hole and the growth of the galaxy. So here is a sequence of two galaxies merging with supermassive black holes in them. And here is a simulation with two galaxies merging without supermassive black holes. And so the idea is that when two galaxies merge, the process of gravitational interaction will drive gas and dust towards the center and create a whole lot of star formation here and there. But in this case, because there are also the supermassive black holes, they accrete. As a result, I mean, when they become AGN, the energetic processes due to this accretion will blow out a lot of the gas. So there is a regular, whereas here, because of the absence of the supermassive black holes, there would be sort of a runaway star formation due to all the gas being driven towards the center. In this case, that would be regulated by the accreting supermassive black hole depositing energy and sort of heating up the gas so that you would not, that would sort of quench the star formation that might occur. So what do we know about the phenomenon of accreting supermassive black holes or AGN? So all substantially accreting supermassive black holes appear to create bipolar synchrotron emitting outflows. So this is an example of that. But we call these jets. But these jets, as you can see here, tend to get confined within the galaxy itself. So the jets are best visible in radio wavelengths, but they're also visible at other wavelengths, as this example shows. It's a very famous active galactic nucleus called 3C273. And here is shown overlaid images of the jet, the synchrotron jet of this galaxy, at infrared, which is the red optical, which is the green, X-ray, which is the blue, and radio, which is these contours. So synchrotron emission can go all the way down to X-ray energies. Although we cannot spatially resolve the central part of the accreting supermassive black hole, because of spectroscopy, we have a fairly good idea of things going on there. So this is not real data. This is an artist's impression. But we do know that around the accretion that's happening around the supermassive black hole, there are clouds of gas which emit emission lines. And that they're driven by the gravity of the supermassive black hole. We know that because the emission lines have enormous widths. And if we interpret those widths as due to Doppler broadening, then it implies speeds of 10,000 kilometers per second or even 50,000 kilometers per second. So these gas clouds are, we expect, Keplerian driven by the supermassive black hole. As you get further away, that is, the temperatures get down enough that gas and dust can survive. And we do know that there is such molecular gas and dust in a sort of toroidal geometry. I can get into reasons why we know that later. And also, there, of course, there's gas that extends throughout the galaxy and of much lower density, and that is also ionized by the radiation from the accretion around the supermassive black hole. Now, as I said, all accreting supermassive black holes seem to create bipolar jets of synchrotron-emitting plasma. Most of the time, that is confined within the host galaxy. But in a minority of accreting supermassive black holes, the jets come out to be really of very high kinetic power. They are relativistic. They are relativistic at launch. And they get well outside the host galaxy up to scales of hundreds of kiloparsecs. So this is a picture showing the galaxy, that is the stellar emission. These are all the stars. And then the accreting supermassive black hole at the center has created these synchrotron-emitting jets, which go well outside onto scales of hundreds of kiloparsecs. We know that this is outflow because the blobs of plasma emitting radio emission can actually be tracked by imaging at multiple epochs, and the speeds that we derive. So this is an accreting supermassive black hole radio image, And the center of it has been imaged at very, very high resolution on a parsec scale at multiple epochs. And you can see the separation of this plasma blob. And that implies speeds, relativistic speeds. So basically, we appear to have two kinds of accreting supermassive black holes. It's not yet clear whether this is an actual dichotomy or it's a matter of degree and so on. That's a debated issue. But the most of them have, at most, mildly relativistic jets. They appear, in at least in the near neighborhood, to be especially in what we call spiral galaxies. These are galaxies which have both that bulge component that I spoke about and also a distribution of stars which are rotationally supported. On the other hand, the highly relativistic jets, the high kinetic power jets which get out well outside the host galaxy, appear to occur preferentially in the elliptical type hosts, that is, effectively galaxies which only have a bulge, you can say, without this rotationally supported disk component. There have been ideas that the one kind is because it's a supermassive black hole is spinning, and the other kind is because it is not spinning, but that idea has not gained ground because even whenever attempts have been made to measure the spin of the black hole, even accreting black holes of that kind show jets. So in the context of the co-evolution of galaxies and supermassive black holes, the mildly relativistic quenched jets will obviously deposit energy in the near neighborhood of the central region of the galaxy, whereas the highly relativistic jets have the capacity to deposit energy on a much larger scale. So there are these two different phenomena by which the co-evolution of galaxy and supermassive black holes can occur. Sure. No, the idea that was propounded was that highly spinning black holes will produce these high kinetic power jets, which means that then the low kinetic power jets should not show accreting black holes with high spin. But in fact, observations indicate that even though they have high spin, so then that high spin idea cannot explain necessarily the dichotomy. You mean how much? What's the value? Larger than 0.5 parameter, larger than spin parameter, larger than 0.5. So like 0.8 and so on. So basically, people have looked at the gravitational broadening. There is this ion K alpha line, which is emitted at 6.4 keV. And that is broadened gravitationally because of the proximity to the black hole. And if it's a spinning black hole, the material can get that much closer to the black hole than if it's not spinning. People use that to, you know, infer.
So you're saying that it's still a threshold. The difference between 0.5 and 0.9 is much greater than the difference between 0.5 and 0.9. So, in other words, the jet power is a very strong function of spin, especially in high spin. So I wonder if maybe are you concerned then, or should we be concerned, that that's probably a somewhat different state than the state that produced the jet? Otherwise, don't they run into interpretation issues?
Well, I have to say, I'm not an expert on the ion K alpha broadening, but my understanding is that when, for example, 3C120, which is on these famous stadiums, was monitored both in X-rays and in radio parsec scale imaging. And so you can see there, I have a movie of that which I can show you later, that if you monitor the X-ray light curve, there are dips in the X-ray light curve, followed by ejection of a plasma blob. So the way that is interpreted is that the X-rays are taken as coming from the accretion. So the accretion rate takes a dip. In other words, you know, matter is swallowed into the black hole, and then it's followed by the ejection of a plasma. So so in that sense, it seems as if the time lag between, you know, the accretion and the ejection of a plasma is fairly small. I mean, it's certainly like observable. And so
that's true for systems that are very marginal, right? That are right near the. So if you thought thick disks were critical for jet launching, we needed some sort of ADAP or IAP column, then systems like MH7, which have a very low accretion rate, almost certainly don't go through these fluctuations, even though there are occasional blobs, and you do see this reasonably continuous jet in movies that fluctuates around, but it's not one of these ballistic blobs. So that could, I mean, I could guess that could be a fundamentally different situation than something that's very close to the transition, the ADAP transition, that's fluctuating above and below, right?
Yeah, I haven't thought about it like that, actually. Yeah.
I'm just curious how many
ideas
I should ask.
Yeah. No, you're right. I think you're right. Yeah, I have to think about that. It would be interesting to look at, because now there's more and more ion K alpha confident measurements of, I mean, there was this whole phase when all that was got a big bad name, but now there's more confident results. So yeah, I think it's interesting to look at that. Oh, you mean absolute numbers?
Yeah,
No. AGNs are in their thousands. No. So this kind of image, it takes a lot of doing. So we know thousands and thousands of AGNs. About 15% of those do this. So this is easy to see because it's very easy to image these synchrotron jets with radio imaging. These jets are quenched within the galaxy, so there's much fewer observations of those. So I would say those would be in the hundreds. Yeah. Yeah, but roughly, not 85, no. Maybe we know a couple hundred of the thousands of AGNs. I mean, yes, 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 and we have no reason to believe otherwise because everyone we've looked at shows, right? It's not so easy to do, and it's also not so attractive to do because you know you don't land up with beautiful images like this. So that's part of the reason. But
cluster that was imaged long enough has bubbles. There's a threshold to detect bubbles. If you pass that threshold in the mixed resolutions, you see them. And that would suggest the others. So it suggests that anytime you don't see them, it's just a detection deficiency.
Bubbles are not the same as jets.
That's true.
Yes.
That's true.
Right. So in terms of AGNs depositing energy in the host galaxy and that way regulating star formation in the host galaxy, obviously these are radio images of the high kinetic power jets, and clearly there is evidence for outflow and therefore deposition of energy. The low kinetic power jet AGNs are also associated with winds, maybe not collimated plasma outflow, but certainly hot winds from the accretion disk. Those are not that commonly imaged, but there's very strong evidence in spectroscopy. So, apologize for the sort of boring image, but these are emission lines from the AGN, and in those lines, they show these absorption troughs, which are evidence for outflow in the form of winds. And so they're mostly seen like that. There are occasional objects where you can actually image them. So this is an example of low kinetic power jet AGN, where this is the radio image of it. And so you can see this collimated outflow, which then maybe encounters shocks and then kind of forms lobes. And spectroscopy with the Hubble Space Telescope of this was done with the spectra, with the slit aligned in that direction. And that is what this is showing. So this is emission from one emission line. And it is showing that, so this is this, the position of the nucleus. And here you see this clump, which is, if you measure it, about 50 parsecs away from the center. And it shows very high velocity. So velocities of about 1,000 kilometers per second, which shows that even like tens of parsecs from the accreting supermassive black hole, gas can be accelerated. And this is an example more like what Avery was mentioning, where you have a high kinetic power jet AGN, which has created these synchrotron emitting jets. And the blue light is the X-ray image. And it shows that these radio jets have created cavities because in these regions, there is low emission from X-rays. So we do have such individual examples where we can see that the yes.
So can you go back to the previous? So you mentioned something like there's evidence for acceleration at 50 parsecs. So could you clarify what I mean exactly? So do you
okay. So you have. I can show you later the picture of the AGN. But there's a regular sort of spiral galaxy here, and there's an AGN in the center, which shows all the typical characteristics of emission lines, et cetera. The radio image shows that there is this collimated outflow. We don't know exactly where the nucleus is. We don't know if it is here or somewhere here. But it's somewhere in this region. So this is a collimated outflow. And it's showing evidence for shocks and then, you know, some more plasma. Now, the spectroscopy was done with the slit placed parallel to this. So your dispersion axis is this. And that is what this is showing. I tilted it like this because, so this is an image in the optical emission line of that galaxy. So it is showing you some sort of, you know, gas in elongated in that direction. This is the slit of the spectrograph. And so here's the spectrum. So here you're seeing, so the slit is like this. The light is dispersed like that. But we do have spatial resolution in this direction. So this is the nuclear part, and then you're going away from the nucleus in either way. And you see this clump here. So the nucleus is roughly here, and then, and there the emission line is just, you know, showing some sort of Gaussian profile. As you go to this pixel, this is roughly 50 parsec away. You see that there is emission also here. So it's blue shifted from the systemic to this value. And that turns out to be about 1,000 kilometers per second. So effectively, from a 50 parsec from here, so here,
I'm confused that this is, I guess it's not evidence for outflow, it's not evidence for acceleration.
Well, because here there is no velocity at 1,000 kilometers.
Right.
Only here there is.
So that means that there's a blob that's coming out.
Yeah.
Is it speeding up or slowing down? That's the difference.
No, but it's higher velocity than what it is here. Because you don't see at this position, right, you don't see 1,000 kilometers per second velocity.
Sure, but there might have been high acceleration in that region, which accelerated up to.
It may have stopped at 50 parsec. Yeah, sure. But it has gone from not being 1,000 kilometers per second to being 1,000 kilometers.
I guess the point, you don't see anything. You say, I guess, so there's a knob that's coming out at 1,000 kilometers per second, very actually accelerated to that velocity. I think that's the harder question to answer.
Well, that's true, but it is before this,
right?
It's before 50 parsec. I mean,
I imagine close to a black hole is easy to accelerate, but if you get farther away, I mean, 50 parsec away, then I don't think there's an acceleration mechanism at that distance.
Correct. So that's why, I mean, the speculation, did this synchrotron plasma drive a gas and accelerate it,
okay,
for example?
Continuously accelerating it, that's the speculation.
Not necessarily continuously, because we know that close to it, there is no, there's that velocity doesn't exist, right? It exists. So our spatial resolution is of this much. We don't have finer spatial resolution than that. And so here there's no high speed, and here there is high speed. So by the time it has reached 50 parsec, it has acquired that speed. So then, you know, what drove it is the question.
Like there's a core, but then there's a tail of emission that doesn't necessarily line up with the slip. It's a little bit tilted, maybe almost 45 degrees.
Oh, you mean this?
No. The red ridge.
This
that,
one?
There. The yellow business, right? From there on, right?
Yeah, this part.
So that looks like that might be related to some of the features that you're looking at here. If you change the orientation of the slip, this high velocity.
Right. I mean, ideally, one would have liked a series of slits, mm-hmm. You know, 1, 2, 3, like that. You know, you sort of raster scan across. This was an HST observation. I mean, it's not easy to get that. It has been done by my collaborator on this work for another AGN called Markarian 78. It has been done, but in this case, this was a nice case where one sees the radio image and all that. But yeah, I mean, ideally, if we could have put the slit, you know, here, etc., we would have got a data cube of the emission, and then one could have said much more than one can with this. Yeah. So then, how do we, I mean, the point is we know that there are outflows, we know that the speed, there are mechanisms possible to have feedback, but we still don't understand what are the fundamental set of parameters that actually drive AGN. We don't know to explain all the observed properties of accreting supermassive black holes with a set of fundamental parameters, say the mass of the black hole, the spin rate, or something, the host galaxy mass, something like that. We don't have such a set. So if you're still in the business of trying to understand the whole range of their properties and find and mapping those onto a set of fundamental parameters. So I'll sort of illustrate some such investigations. So first, looking at the high kinetic power jets, as I said, they're all launched relativistically. And so then, in the nuclei, relativistic aberration kicks in. And so the emission that we see from this relativistic component is Doppler beamed, as we call. And so the Doppler factor is given by this. And this graph shows the dependence of the Doppler factor on viewing angle. And one can see, and these different curves are for different Lorentz factors. And so one can see that as the Lorentz factor increases, the dependence on the inclination angle is much, much sharper, as expected. And we also can track the speed at which the outflow occurs using parsec scale radio imaging. And of course, what we are measuring, I mean, you have a component coming. What we are measuring is just projected against the plane of the sky. So we are measuring what is called proper motion or transverse motion. And that apparent speed is given by that formula. And that also depends on the inclination angle and the Lorentz factor. But of course, it peaks at some point close to the center because we are seeing this in projection. So now, these relativistically beamed AGNs are also very strong gamma ray emitters. So one of the things, and one expects that the gamma rays are also relativistically beamed. So one of the things we've looked at is relationships between the apparent speed of the plasma blob and the gamma ray emission. So this is a plot of that. The apparent speed data are from what is called the Mojave Project, which is led by Matt Lister and company using the American VLBA, so-called very long baseline array, which does radio imaging. And the gamma ray data come from the Fermi telescope. And so what is plotted here on the y-axis is the apparent speed of the plasma blob. And on the x-axis is the luminosity in gamma rays. And Fermi has different gamma ray bands ranging from about 100 eV, 100 MeV up to GeV. So these different bands are plotted. And on the face of it, it seems as if the apparent speed of the plasma blob correlates with the gamma ray luminosity, as one would expect. However, these AGNs, which launch relativistic jets, they kind of come in two flavors. So this is showing an optical spectrum of these AGNs. And you can see that there is a continuum, but there are also these very strong emission lines. And as I said before, these are atomic emission lines coming from hot gas, very close to the accreting supermassive black hole. So Keplerian driven by the black hole with very high velocity. And these emission lines are a hallmark of AGNs, or accreting supermassive black holes. But the ones that are relativistically beamed, not all of them show these emission lines. And if you look at just the radio image, so for example, these two, you can't tell which of them, these radio images look very similar. Both of them have these synchrotron emitting jets, plumes, et cetera, shocks, and all that. And these are high kinetic power jets, both are relativistic, all that. So, but just by looking at the radio image, you wouldn't be able to tell which of them has these kinds of emission lines and which of them don't. And having those emission lines implies that there is this gas, which is Keplerian driven, very close to the accreting supermassive black hole. So it's a debate as to whether we don't see them because they don't exist, or we don't see them because the continuum is so dominant that the lines are kind of swamped in the noise. But if one sort of uses this to distinguish between the gamma ray emitting AGNs, it turns out that the ones with emission lines, which are this red box here, are somewhat different from the ones without the emission lines. So in the jargon, these are called quasars, and these are called VLLAC objects, just in case you've come across those terms. So what is plotted here is the distributions, the represented by these box and whisker plots, for these two kinds of AGN. Of course, there's a third kind as well. These are the objects which are not relativistically beamed. There are not too many of them in the sample, but I just left them in there. I won't say much about them. So you can see that the gamma ray luminosity for the ones with emission lines is different from the ones without. It's systematically higher. So this is not a quantitative axis. This is just a labeled axis. So this is showing you the distribution in a box and whisker plot. So the box represents the interquartile range of the gamma luminosity in different bands. And the whiskers represent, 1.5 into the interquartile range.
And what's the difference between different boxes?
So it's just the different gamma ray bands. So this is the low energy gamma ray band, and then higher and higher. So it's just showing you that in all the gamma ray bands, the relativistic AGN with emission lines have systematically higher gamma luminosity than the ones without. So,
the broad emission line,
right? Yes, the broad emission line. Yes. So then this plot, which I showed you earlier, where there is a correlation between the apparent speed of the plasma blob and the gamma ray luminosity. I just replotted that with different colors for the two kinds of objects. And it seems now that what was looking like a correlation is actually simply due to the systematic difference between the red dots and the blue dots. That is, the systematic difference between beamed AGN with the emission lines, and therefore the gas high-speed gas clouds, and the ones without. In fact, if one looks at the radio luminosity from the nucleus, that also shows a very systematic difference between the two. So then it seems as if it is not just a straightforward correlation between the apparent speeds and the gamma ray luminosity. And in fact, if one looks for, so for example, here we have the radio flux density from the nucleus, which includes all these blobs of plasma that are coming out at relative speed, and the gamma ray luminosity, and the two kinds of objects. So here there's almost no relationship. Here there is maybe a weak relationship. So obviously the physical relationships between the blobs of plasma and the gamma ray luminosity is not straightforward, and it depends on the what is this complex mechanism with the gas clouds and the which are very close to the nucleus. So this is showing you also that the apparent speeds are also significantly different between whether the gas clouds are present or not present. I'll just skip these. So, okay, this is just one more thing, which is the gamma ray photon index. So here again, the gamma ray photon index is systematically different between the two kinds of AGNs. And the physical relationship is also different. So here there is a relationship in that the steeper the gamma ray photon index, the lower the gamma ray luminosity. Whereas for the other kind, there seems to be not much of a relationship there.
So you mentioned you look at a number of different gamma ray bands. So that's true for the 100 to 100 MeV to 100 GeV. But it's less true. It's almost driven totally by the PSF, which essentially becomes fixed above GeV. So it's less true for gamma ray bands that start at 1 GeV and go up.
Actually, I skipped this slide, but see here. This is just the plots of the gamma ray luminosity against each other, just to check for. So you can see that, for example, here, there's a bunch of objects.
This is for the Mojave selected sample, right?
No, this is, yes, that's true. Yeah.
So if you look at the total 2FGL sample, or 2LAC sample, there's just plot of correlation.
Yeah, that we don't see in this sample. And here you see these, which are showing an excess in the low gamma ray energy band. And that is probably because of this PSF effect. So there's probably confusion there, and there's additional objects in the band, in the PSF, which are contributing to the low gamma ray energy. So see the gamma ray luminosities are correlated very tightly for most of the objects, but in the low, this is the low gamma ray energy band. So here you have some objects with an excess. So they are very likely to be those where you have additional contribution from some other sources in the PSF. So basically, to sort of untangle all this, one of the things one needs is an indicator of the inclination of the object to the observer. So it is traditional in this field to do that using the radio emission. So the idea is that you have, so these are two different high kinetic power jet AGNs. And the idea is that this portion, now here this is on the scale of a kiloparsec or so, is what contains the plasma, which is very relativistic. So this radio emission would be highly beamed. And by the time it gets out here, it would be not beamed anymore. So then if one took a ratio of this emission to the rest of it, the idea is that that would give you an indicator of the orientation of the object. So for example, here, in this case, it's a very large ratio between this emission and the rest. Whereas here, it's a relatively small ratio. And so one would get that. But for the objects that I was looking at, which have the gamma ray data, these are extremely powerful AGNs. They're also highly variable. So then if one wants to do something like this, one needs simultaneous measurements of this nuclear emission and of the total emission, which is not that easy to come by. So we could not use this traditional way to look at the angle of orientation in order to untangle the actual physics that's going on. So as a second best measure, we tried, this is still work in progress, so we tried looking at the optical images of the galaxy. So there are measurements by some people who've used very good optical facilities with very sharp point spread functions, as we call them, good resolution, so that the central accreting supermassive black hole is somewhat at least separated from the rest of the galaxy. Ideally, one wants the Hubble Space Telescope, and we are working on using those data as well, but this was the start. And so then here are the cross cuts across this kind of a measurement, which show you the nucleus and then the galaxy. So one can separate the accreting supermassive black hole and the light from the rest of the galaxy. And so obviously we don't expect the stellar emission to be relativistically beamed. We only expect the nuclear emission to be beamed. So the ratio of this nuclear to stellar emission would give you an indicator of the orientation of the accreting supermassive black hole. So using that, we've looked for correlations with the gamma ray luminosity. So on the x-axis is this ratio of the nuclear to host galaxy in the optical. And on the y-axis, here is the apparent speeds of the plasma blob. And these are the gamma ray luminosities. These are only for the objects which do not have the emission lines, because these data were available for only those. And one does begin to see that maybe one can actually look for functional relationships with this approach. Now, I will shift gears a little bit to illustrate what one can get by actually taking this approach and using rigorously selected samples in order to untangle effects of orientation and effects of real physics. So these now are very nearby accreting supermassive black holes of the low with a low kinetic energy kinetic power jets, and even in these objects there are objects with those very broad emission lines implying these high velocity gas clouds Keplerian driven near the accreting supermassive black hole and those without. And it is highly debated as to what causes the difference. But there's a lot of evidence in favor of the idea that around the accreting supermassive black hole is this material of molecular gas and dust. Remember I said that when you get far enough from the supermassive black hole, the temperatures are cool enough that molecular gas and dust can exist. And we have reason to believe that they exist in a sort of a toroidal geometry. And so then, when this toroidal sort of structure is edge-on with respect to us, that would hide or obscure all the stuff that's going on very close to the accreting supermassive black hole. Whereas if it is pole-on with respect to us, then all the central activity would be visible. And so that is stated to be the reason why in some cases you see these broad lines and in some cases you don't see the broad lines, because this toroidal structure is obscuring those high velocity Keplerian driven clouds, and in the other cases it's not. Now, in order to test this, we use a sample of such active galaxies. They are called type 1s and type 2s. So the type 1s are the ones with these broad emission lines, and the type 2s are the ones where the torus is supposedly hiding the central activity. And we chose them so that they were, from other parameters, purported to be intrinsically similar. So we chose them to have similar host galaxy types, similar stellar luminosities, similar values for the proxy for the AGN power. So this faraway gas, which is also ionized by the accretion disk, would have a luminosity which is independent of inclination, because no matter how it is inclined, so that we use that as a proxy for the AGN power. And so we take such a sample. So we've matched them, as these histograms show, in all these parameters which are not dependent on orientation. So for example, redshift, the proxy for the AGN power, the stellar luminosity of the host galaxy, type of the host galaxy, the bulge host galaxy luminosity, etc. And skip that. And we've looked at what the kiloparsec scale structure of the plasma emission is. We've looked at what the X-ray continuum from the nucleus looks like. And we've looked at what the parsec scale structure of these jets look like. So the prediction would be, the prediction of this idea that these two things are different only because of how this obscuring molecular gas and dust is oriented, the prediction would be that the kiloparsec scale structure should not look, should have similar luminosity, should not be any different. The parsec scale radio structure should not be any different, provided there is no relativistic beaming. And the X-rays should be attenuated when this molecular gas and dust is in the way. So the hard X-rays would be less attenuated because such material is transparent to hard X-rays. The soft X-rays are what are absorbed. So you would expect to see less soft X-rays. You would expect to see the similar radioluminosities. And so that's exactly what we find. So I'll just zip through the results. So this shows the radio emission we detected with an instrument called the Giant Meter Wave Radio Telescope, which is in India, and images with resolutions of roughly a few arcseconds or a few kiloparsecs. And the radio emission superposed on the stellar emission of the host galaxy, they turn out to be very similar in the two types, just as we predicted. The parsec scale structure of the plasma outflow, again, is similar. Both kinds of these AGNs show the whole range of structures. So some of them are just blobs. Some of them show this so-called core jet structure in both cases. And some of them show this sort of linear structure in both cases. And that's just a plot of the luminosities, and they're all similar. And what we looked at, we had simultaneous measurements of the emission from the plasma blobs on the parsec scale and on the kiloparsec scale. And so we're not affected by variability. So we looked at the ratio of these two. And if there were significant relativistic beaming, we would expect the parsec scale radio emission to be Doppler beamed with respect to the kiloparsec scale emission. And what we find is that there is no significant difference in the two kinds as far as that is concerned. So there is very little evidence for relativistic beaming. And as far as the X-ray emission is concerned, what we are measuring is the X-ray continuum and an emission line. This is just illustrating the model fits that were used to and analyze the X-ray data. So there is an ion line and then all these different X-ray components which were used to fit the X-ray measurements. These are data from archival data from the XMM Newton telescope. These are just examples of the X-ray spectra. So you see the INK alpha line, which was mentioned before in virtually every case. And more examples. And this is the result. So in both, so this shows the X-ray luminosity in the softer range, and one sees exactly what was predicted, namely the ones where we expect this obscuring material in the way shows less X-ray luminosity systematically compared to the other kind. In the hard X-rays, the difference is reduced, as expected. This is what is called the absorbing column density. So the X-rays that we measure, when we fit those different components, one can also fit how much of absorption is occurring. And you would expect that if this toroidal structure is in the line of sight, there would be heavier absorption. And that is shown pretty clearly here. So the objects where you expect absorption have a much higher so-called column density. This is always quoted in equivalent hydrogen column density. So they have higher, systematically higher column densities than in the other kind. And that ion K alpha line, the strength of that ion K alpha line is again systematically different, again as we expect. So the obscured kind show much higher strength of the ion K alpha line because the ratio, the strength is after all the ratio between the luminosity of the line and the continuum, and the continuum being depressed, you would see a stronger INK alpha line compared to the others. So I will end with a small advertisement of a current project that we are doing, which is to map the spectroscopically map the structure of the host galaxy and the AGN for a bunch of nearby accreting supermassive black holes. So the idea is to use what is called an integral field unit, which is basically just a fancy way of saying we're doing spectroscopy for every piece of the image of the galaxy. And so one gets what one calls a data cube, which is illustrated here. So one gets the image of the galaxy at every wavelength. So that's what is this data cube. So this is the image. So you have two spatial dimensions, and this is the wavelength dimension. So if you took a slice like that, you would get an image at that particular wavelength. Whereas if you took a slice perpendicular, you would get basically a spectrogram, a long slit spectrogram. And this is one of the first results. So this is a galaxy with an accreting supermassive black hole, which is part of actually an interacting system. And so we have images of this galaxy at every optical wavelength. And from that, we can actually determine what is the ionization state. And what this shows here is that all these blobs, which are in the host galaxy, as expected, they show the ionization characteristics of being ionized by hot stars, whereas the very, very central part shows characteristics of being ionized by the accreting supermassive black hole, and intermediate clouds of gas show ionization, which is a combination of the two. So with this kind of study, we hope to study in detail how the accreting supermassive black hole impacts the host galaxy. Another example from our study is this, where here is plotted in yellow the emission from the alpha line, the Balmer line, which is an indicator of star formation. And what is plotted in blue is the oxygen 3 doublet, which is a forbidden transition, which is primarily ionized by the AGN. And you can see the structures are very different. And here is the radio image of the same galaxy, which shows an elongation in the same direction as this oxygen 3 emission. Again, illustrating what I showed earlier, where the radio jets are probably driving or interacting at least with the hot gas, which is causing these forbidden emission lines. So, we have a sample of about 120 such objects, and this has just started, so the observations are ongoing. And we expect to combine these with radio imaging follow-up so that we have much more detailed image. This is very coarse. This is a very coarse image of the plasma. We expect to have much better images with much better detail. And so then we can compare and investigate the actual physics of the interaction between these plasma jets, how they deposit their energy, and the host galaxy. So with that advertisement, I'll stop.
So considering the time, maybe one or two questions, and then we'll just go down to lunch and talk informally then.
So one of the issues that I remember was there was this torus or whatever that sort of material is, was what is this geometry and how far from the black hole is it? And
Not with my data, but people have, the closest we've got to actually imaging those things is with the Very Large Telescope of the European Observatory, and with the at the infrared wavelengths, they have tried to image these things. Very, very difficult, and they, you know, it's the interferometric technique, so you're actually only measuring some Fourier components of the Fourier transform of the sky. And so, but they are able to see elongation in the expected direction of the infrared structure. And they've done that for only a handful.
And how big is this structure?
So, it's expected to range from roughly 50 parsecs to about 200 parsecs.
And is that what's up there? Is that?
Yeah, I mean it's roughly consistent. Yeah.
I see. So it's so big that I shouldn't think of it as being some sort of the outer edge of the accretion disk. It's really like the accretion disk, and then there's a separate structure outside.
Well, some people like to argue that it is indeed, you know, just the extension, and it's just the lowering temperatures which allows different material to exist. So you have the accretion disk, very, very hot, you know, millions of degrees, so that's all plasma. Then as you go away, then some people will argue that these clouds of gas, which I spoke about, that are Keplerian driven by the supermassive black hole, that they are just sort of the outer sort of fluctuations and density fluctuations in the outer regions of the accretion disk. So you're getting further away.
Even that far out, the accretion disk is kind of flat, rotating thing.
Well, yes. We obviously don't see, we can't see the accretion disk. But there is evidence that there are not too many studies, but there are studies which have shown that, so if you look at the width of the emission lines that are coming from these gas clouds, and if you interpret that as due to kinematic Doppler broadening, and then if you have an independent handle on the inclination, people have found that there is a correlation between the two, in that when the accretion disk is more pole on, the widths of these lines are lower. So if they were indeed in a sort of flat geometry, that would predict this effect. Because then when the clouds are rotating like this, you would expect a larger Doppler broadening as opposed to the clouds being rotating like that. And one actually sees that. There are not too many studies, but whatever few studies are there indicate this. So that is what tempts people to suggest that, you know, it's all sort of roughly, yeah. And then the torus is like the very outermost structure that exists. because it's far enough away that it's below the sublimation temperatures of gas and dust, so you have gas and dust.
And don't they see maser disks extend out to this sort of distances?
Yes.
Maybe not 100 parsecs, but tens of parsecs.
Yes. Yes, that's another thing. There is there are tens of accretions of massive black holes where masers have been seen, and they can be monitored over time, and so they are seen to move in a disk-like.
Let's thank Rajpal again, and please join us for lunch.